Ooh.
Ooh.
No, I say to the fans that the fans are the fans and the fans have the right to have their opinions and to have their reaction. Football heritage.
I'm so happy, believe me. I'm so happy.
Lewandowski, you know, Robert Lewandowski.
Dream team. Fire. Swoosh.
I am flabbergasted and they're here. I wouldn't even let them on the bus after the match. I'm going to taxi back to Manchester.
The only time a tennis ball's ever made me angry. What's viral on Twitter for us tonight is tennis balls.
These boys are fucking mentality giants. It's unbelievable.
This is a great football and college produced players and where we play that rubbish.
Yeah. In August 2020, yeah, I'm taking over, and that's been decided.
I'm angry, Tony, I have to be honest with you. Stephen Kenny, we've won it. So go on, go back to Scotland and get lost.
And I'm certainly going to be a part of that. I'm going to manage that. I'm going to make sure we're even better.
And fighting is there!
It took about 15 minutes into the Arsenal and Chelsea game on Sunday before we realised that Arsenal are very much in mid-season Arsenaling form and that Romelu Lukaku in this Chelsea side with this particular manager could be a very, very dangerous prospect indeed for any team with title aspirations this season. Hello and welcome to this week's Three at the Back podcast, Casting an Eye Over Proceedings. With me is, as usual, Phil and Enda. How are you, lads?
How are we doing?
Well, lads.
So with another Premier League weekend in the books, pre-season assumptions are quickly being busted or confirmed. We'll be taking a look at some of the big talking points shortly. And in part two, we'll be joined by Emmett Gates to take a look at Syria, where Inter's fire sale this summer has evened the playing field at the top of the table, which could make for one of the closest seasons in some time for Italian football fans. But first, lads, onto the action a little bit closer to home here in the Premier League. And Phil, let's start with Liverpool's 2-0 win over Burnley. And aside from Burnley's 1-11 shirt number action, which was absolutely superb in this day and age in modern football, and very Burnley, I thought, as well, for want of a better phrase. But coming out of that game, it did seem like Harvey Elliott grabbed the plaudits in a pretty impressive full Premier League debut there.
Yeah, it was great to see that, like, not least on this podcast, but in general, there's been a decent bit of hype around him, kind of low-level hype, but hype nonetheless, based off his really quite good year on loan with Blackburn Rovers in the Championship last year, and a pretty prominent showing in pre-season. It looked like even before the departure of Shaqiri to Lyon that Elliott was going to have at least a more increased role this year in the squad than people might have envisaged, and that he probably wasn't going to go out on loan. To see him get his first Premier League start in the first game back in front of a full Anfield was great. I think it was good in terms of he was always going to get a good reception, and even if things didn't go exactly to plan, he was going to get lauded for kind of even smaller things. So I think it was a good way to build his confidence. But then he delivered in spades in terms of, like, we know about his technical ability on the ball. It was really nice to see him keep that midfield role that he'd played a little bit in pre-season, because when he came to the club as a 16-year-old, the idea was probably that he was more of a kind of a Mo Salah wide forward who cuts in on his left. He might just lack the pace to do that at the very top of the game. Not to say that he can't be an option there, but he mightn't achieve all that he could achieve in his career in that position just because of maybe a slight lack of pace. But he definitely has the technical ability to play at home against kind of a bottom 14 side, even one as physical as Burnley, and one who understandably decided to probably target him a little bit, not unfairly, not in the same way that maybe the centre forwards were Suplex and Matip and people like that. But I thought that he handled quite well what Burnley threw at him, and I think we'll probably see a little bit of that now, especially at home and especially against the bottom 14. Elliott kind of getting in a slightly different midfield role for a club Liverpool, less the functional stuff that we've seen before and a little bit more expressive and attacking. So I thought it was quite encouraging. Performance overall, I thought, was pretty standard, if good, still moving along quite nicely and moving through the gears. But yeah, I think Elliott was definitely the standout piece of news coming out of the day.
Yeah, it wasn't that kind of frightening level of efficiency that we saw against Norwich, but I don't think it was ever going to be, considering, you know, Burnley are a much superior side to Norwich. They know what they're about. You know, the 4-4-2, 1-11 Brexit jokes prior to the match, but that's exactly what they are. And early on, especially how they started, it looked like McNeil might have the beating of Alexander-Arnold. So the goals came at a very good time for Liverpool, and it just seemed to calm everything down a bit. But you know, we said in the WhatsApp group before the game, this is the type of Liverpool midfield that we'd like to see in a home game against Burnley, which is, you know, your more technical and slightly more attacking-minded players rather than the more functional midfield that I fully expect to see on Sunday against Chelsea, for example. The crowd being back, I'm not sure, fully helped them, especially when Keita lost the ball at the edge of his box there early on. There was a few groans, but, you know, all in all, two wins to open the season and an important win against Burnley, who've gotten some good results at Anfield in the past couple of years. And Van Dijk looks like he's improving all the time, a much better level than we saw in pre-season, for example. And the second goal was absolutely fantastic. So it'll be interesting to see how they play it against Chelsea, particularly if Chelsea played the same 3-4-3 formation, and how Alexander-Arnold and Tsimikas can manage against the wing-backs. So I'm really looking forward to seeing how that match plays out. And I think that'll give us a much better idea of where Liverpool are at the moment.
Phil, one thing I was struck by in this game, and something that we were left without last season pretty much, was the range of passing from Arnold and Van Dijk. I mean, an absolute joy to behold. I mean, I was kind of thinking back to when we had Xabi Alonso, and him probably, aside from maybe Gerrard, being the only kind of player capable of striking those long range passes. Now we have it in spades with two of our defenders, and it makes the game so much wider, and you know how they brought the likes of Tsimikas into play and Mané down the left hand side, and obviously as Enda said, the long pass up front for that created Mané's goal was an absolute joy to behold.
Yeah, like you said, it makes such a difference to Liverpool's play. It makes them such a different proposition. Last year they tried it with, when they had Kabak back there, they tried it a bit, and obviously it was part of the thinking behind initially moving Henderson and Fabinho back as well. It just changes the proposition totally. Not only were they landing the ball on Mane, which is a typical out ball in the kind of Van Dijk era, but for that goal, actually the second goal as well, you see it was Elliot who received it, and he was actually on the receiving end a good bit, which again I thought was interesting. It's not something that would have been typical of Liverpool's midfield under Klopp thus far. It is normally an out ball, mostly to Mane, obviously sometimes to Salah, and then that kind of switch the odd time between the fullbacks as well. But I thought it was interesting to see Elliot positioned that wide out in receipt of that ball, and then obviously the move coming inside. So it completely changes the proposition from Liverpool. It gives them an out. It gives kind of a release of a pressure valve, but it's also an extremely potent attacking weapon because the pitch just gets a lot wider. And like you said, with Tsimikas, he's settled in. Like he looks like a fella who has had a year where he's been fucking knuckled down and really like pushed to the pin of his collar. And like he got 4 minutes in the Premier League or 6 minutes or something in his first season. Helped that Robertson didn't get hurt, but by all accounts, he wasn't exactly pulling up trees, and he might have been a slightly slower learner than maybe Robertson had been into the system. But he looks like he's been indoctrinated now. He plays like a Liverpool player. And they are making really good use of him and Arnold on the other side with that pitch and the return of those long passes. I completely agree. I think it's changed the proposition from Liverpool, and I think it's done a lot to make them look more threatening than they were last season.
I didn't get to see this one live now, so I was kind of watching it in dribs and drabs after the fact. And while I was kind of keeping track of affairs on Twitter, I saw a couple of mentions from people suggesting a little bit of frostiness maybe between Mané and Salah. Now, I thought we were kind of over all of this. And then obviously when I was watching it back, I kind of had that viewpoint in my head, so I couldn't really get out of it anytime I saw Mané and Salah connect. And there was obviously one chance where Mané had in the box and Salah was wide open to his right. Didn't pass, went for the shot. I mean, do you sense this frostiness? Is there a little bit of tension between the two? Obviously, Salah, I think the word is that that there will be an extension, whereas Mané, there doesn't seem to be one on the horizon just yet, considering they have been on a bit of a contract extension spree. Could Mané be the odd one out there going forward, maybe?
Yeah, I know it's something Enda was pointing out in our WhatsApp as well during the match. I think it's probably fair to say at this point, given all available evidence, they're probably not the absolute best friends. In a squad that seems to relatively get along quite well, they don't seem to be bosom buddies. Salah is obviously an absolute competitive animal in terms of wanting as many goals as possible. And we've seen him in that way that goal scorers do get quite thick with teammates, be it Mane or be it somebody else who doesn't give him the right pass when he thinks it's right. But I think Mane is also probably feeling a little bit of pressure now, not least with the contract situation. I think you're right, Kev, but just because he did have a pretty bad season last year and he was there for most of it. You look at Salah and Liverpool finished third, fair enough, but they definitely had a bad season. Salah can still say he was second top scorer, nearly top scorer in the division again. Mane definitely had a drop from where he has been for Liverpool, and he's probably feeling a little bit of pressure to force things slightly. He got his goal, which I think he took quite nicely, missed a really presentable chance in the first half with that volley that he shinned, and then another save from Pope in the second half. So I think he's probably feeling a little bit of pressure to kind of get things to click. I think in that case, and he does have this tendency, he kind of keeps the head down a little bit too much in that case, and that's never going to make someone like Salah happy. So I think it's probably fair to say they're not best friends. I do think Liverpool look to be prioritising Salah, and I think it's fair enough. I mean, there's only one of them who's multiple-time Golden Boot winner. I know Mane shared it with him one of the times, but there's only one of them who is like one of the fastest goal scorers in Premier League history in terms of goals per game. Salah has earned the right, I think, to be the senior in the partnership. Mane might start to feel the squeak a little bit, but you'd hope that those competitive juices go the right way in terms of kind of spurning his run, and not the wrong way in terms of maybe being a negative influence on the team.
Yeah, I think what makes it so obvious is that, you know, 95% of the Liverpool team are so unselfish and just constantly make the right decision all the time. I mean, you know, there's so much obsession with XG or XA or whatever you want to call it from midfielders now, but, you know, Liverpool have never gotten sucked into that. You know, they've let Alexander-Arnold and Robertson just prosper and keeping that midfield functional with no kind of goals or assists to that midfield's name. And then as soon as you get to Mane and Salah, there does seem to be that kind of healthy competition now that has boiled over into something slightly more verbally aggressive at times. But, you know, that's probably why they won a Champions League and a league title, that kind of standards that they demand from each other. So, you know, I kind of said it tongue-in-cheek in the group at the time, or maybe I'm trying to find some flaws in Liverpool. I don't know anymore. But, you know, it's in the larger scale of things, it's not the biggest deal, but it's the only kind of noticeable lack of relationship that you really have in this Liverpool squad, but it's never really boiled over into anything more dramatic than that. And ultimately these are two players who grew up as, you know, forwards who are now kind of wide strikers, if you like. So they'll always have that hunger for goals. They're not kind of your natural wingers who aren't used to scoring 15-20 goals a season. You know, both of them were extremely prolific in youth careers and kind of, you know, in their early club careers in Belgium and Switzerland. So it's not too surprising that they still have that hunger, and that's contributed so heavily to Liverpool's success. But, you know, overall, it's not really a big deal, but it's just the only time you kind of see a bit of an odd relationship on the pitch with Liverpool, but you know, it's healthy overall.
Elsewhere, Aston Villa picked up their first win of the season, 2-0 against Newcastle. Danny Ings with an early goal of the season contender there. Villa taking one out of the Thomas Frank playbook there with a long throw-in from Matty Cash, resulting in a pretty decent volley from Ings. But I'd be interested to get your views on the Callum Wilson in penalty incident. He was true on goal, absolutely reefed out of it by Emiliano Martinez in goals, but it turns out Wilson was offside. Martinez only ended up getting a yellow card, which I thought was a red. I thought it was a stonewall red. It was kind of akin to a similar scenario to Jordan Pickford and Van Dijk, whereas the tackle happened after the fact. And there was no retrospective action done. Whereas now that rule has been changed and Martinez was punished, but because the offside, because Wilson was offside, there was no penalty. And I think the offside probably saved Martinez from a red.
Yeah, I don't know. Is there that kind of weird thing of the denying of goal scoring opportunity and like the violent conduct and that kind of like change that's happened recently where the double jeopardy thing has come in? I don't know whether he's been saved by that. If it had been actually denying a goal scoring opportunity, if he would have been called in on a red or not. But I agree. I think there's probably a significant degree of misunderstanding, not least from myself, on this as to what you're expected to do in that sort of situation, or what you're expected to see. Like you said, obviously the Pickford one is a clear example from last season, where the offside seemed to have saved Pickford from anything. Martinez, in this case, I'd imagine, like you said, it's the offside that saves him from a red. I think if it's still a live play, he might walk. But I do think, and I think it's something that probably speaks to a wider point about the first couple of weeks of the season. There's this idea of letting the game flow more, and obviously, and there's kind of more grey than black and white. It might have been the case last year. The VAR decision on the offside lines, if they're touching, it's onside, all that sort of stuff. I think there's a lot of grey in the game at the minute, and there's a significant amount that's probably a bit more objective than we've been used to over the last little while. Which I think is going to lead to situations like this for at least a couple of weeks, if not longer, where there will probably be a lot of examples of inconsistency you can point to, or decisions that you don't quite understand, because there's this there are these new edicts, and there seems to be a few more this year than there is other years. Maybe that's just me having only kind of paid attention near the start of the season and got a rush at them, but it feels like there's a lot of change after happening in the game from the end of last season to the start of this. I think the Martinez and Wilson is probably a good example of something that I think we could see a totally different outcome in a couple of weeks' time, and we'll be trying to hold these two situations up and make sense of them. And I think the only answer we're going to be able to give is that the rule book is a little bit more subjective at the minute, and that's making things more difficult.
Yeah, it's a tricky one, because for me, violent conduct is violent conduct, regardless of whether VAR calls it back for an offside or not. I remember Wes Brown getting sent off at Anfield after the referee blew his whistle and completely took a guy out of it, and was sent off, and probably rightfully so. So I don't really see the difference if VAR calls back an offside if there was a violent tackle after that. So again, it's going to take a bit of figuring out. There definitely has been a bit more aggressiveness to the Premier League at the start of the season. Even Mike Dean's been keeping his cards in his pocket, which is very rare for him. But I think overall, it's probably a better thing for the league. I mean, you know, the Fernandez incident, for example, against Southampton, I didn't think for me that was a foul. That was just contact and the game should play on. I know Klopp wasn't overly happy with Burnley, for example. But again, you know, Liverpool can handle themselves pretty well when they need to. So, you know, I'm okay with the concept of trying to let the game flow a little bit more and a bit more aggressiveness coming back into it. But that aside, I thought the Martinez incident, you know, a bit like Perez last night, I think, you know, it for me, that was a red card, and the fact that it was called back for an offside really shouldn't make a difference. I think violent conduct should be judged separately to, you know, the goal scoring opportunity being judged as not being relevant because it was offside. I think they're two very, very different situations, and he kind of got away with it a little bit.
In the United, then 1-1 draw against Southampton, and you just mentioned it there, obviously, the Bruno incident that led to Southampton's goal, which I thought was a pretty decently worked goal up until Fred's huge deflection. So I think it went down as a known goal. But I mean, before the game, looking at either side, it felt like this was either going to be an absolute pummeling on United's side, considering, you know, Southampton's team doesn't really jump out on paper, especially that back four. Although in fairness, Livramento, the fullback from Chelsea, was very, very impressive, and looks like a very decent piece of business from Southampton. But on the United side, I mean, Martial led the line and seems to struggle. And again, we're probably looking back at that Fred and Matic partnership. McTominay came off the bench. You still feel like you're missing something there in midfield that could be refreshed.
Yeah, there was kind of two things that stuck in my mind after the match. Number one, just it was a horribly clumsy performance, really, from almost every player, really, apart from kind of Pogba and Greenwood, who had that bit more of finesse and control about them that you would need in a match like that. And then secondly, it was an almost experimental lineup, really, from Solskjaer. You know, McTominay was excellent against Leeds. Martial didn't have a great preseason, you know, struggled last season before his injury. So Greenwood, I would have expected to be your number nine with Sancho and Pogba either side of him. And it kind of felt like he took Southampton extremely lightly, which, I mean, I was taking them lightly before the game, as long as United, you know, didn't, considering they're probably, apart from Norwich, the away match you would want at this moment in time, with obviously just losing Vestergaard. They've just been lost at Everton. They've lost Danny Ings. And United kind of turned up with that mentality of, you know, we'll check this off and move on. But as we've seen too many times in the last few seasons with United, you know, their head isn't in the game enough, really, in matches like this. Not just the Bruno incident, but I think Matic and Fred gave it away. I was looking at the stats on Monday. I think it was 22 or 24 times between them, between overhit passes or dispossessed. Even Maguire at the end getting dispossessed when Armstrong nearly scored and should have won it. And it would have been tough to argue too much against Southampton deserving more than the points. So yeah, it was extremely clumsy from United from kind of start to finish, from the manager and the players. And it was only really two or three moments of decent football they put together. I mean, Sancho coming on, obviously he doesn't have that connection yet with the players, and you could see that in the runs he was making. They were kind of on top of each other, so that will come in time. And obviously Varane coming in as well will hopefully improve standards, and Cavani. So there's three or four changes that do need to be made. But I mean, the midfield was absolutely tragic on the day, and I'd be very surprised if we see Matic or Fred start again. And you know, it does raise the question of whether there'll be a panic buy in midfield in the next week or so. Obviously linked to Saul, Neves and Camavinga. So it'll be interesting to see what happens there. But it's the type of match that if you do want to be lifting something at the end of May, you would have needed to win quite comfortably. I think, you know, if it had been Liverpool or City or even Chelsea, I think they would have come away from that particular game against that side very comfortably with a 2 or 3 nil, and United were just too sloppy and clumsy, and it was a very tired and exhausting display, which in the second game of the season isn't really what we're hoping for. Again, really Greenwood and Pogba being the only real positives. Wan-Bissaka was okay. De Gea looked a bit more confident than he did last season, but you know, it's not a performance to like panic or scare really any of the top three or four teams who are chasing the title this season.
What did you make of Monday Night Football and Carragher and Neville's efforts to compare Klopp and Ollie over their first 99 games? I mean, statistically, it's pretty similar. And then once you get to the finances, obviously, they're pointing in different trajectories. But Neville seems keen to get to go Ollie in for Harry Kane, which kind of belied their argument there.
Yeah. When Gary Neville talks about United, I think it's best we all switch off, because he just seems to flick this switch from rational, very intelligent pundit to just somebody like a fan camera, almost just kind of spouting whatever pops into his head, which is quite bizarre, really. I don't get half the point he's trying to make. You know, he's kind of half gone in on the owners in the past. He's half gone in on Ollie a little bit. He's been very critical of some of the players, but there's no real consistency to any of the points he tries to make in terms of analysing what's right or wrong with United. And then he gets to the point where throw 150 million at Harry Kane, which wouldn't have really fixed any of the issues that we saw on Sunday. So Carragher, in fairness, has always been, you know, very fair on United. I felt, you know, he's had the odd rant maybe against Pogba or somebody, but that aside, I think his analysis that, you know, a slightly more experienced, tactically aware coach would get more out of, you know, even these group of midfielders, this group of players, than probably Ollie would at the moment. But, you know, the reason for that is we have a manager who's learning on the job, who's done a lot of good things very well off the pitch in particular, in terms of the players he's brought in and the players he's gotten rid of or tried to get rid of. But his weaknesses are kind of the in-game tactical changes or tweaks you need to make, the substitutions. So he's still kind of trying to figure out the best way to manage that. And we hope he'll get there, you know, and that's really what's costing him games like Sunday. So I felt Carragher was pretty accurate in things he said without being too harsh or critical on Solskjaer. And Neville, I didn't really understand the point he was trying to make. I think, you know, United have four positions they were trying to fix. They've upgraded in two of them this summer. They're trying to upgrade a midfield before the end of the transfer window. And I think certainly the number nine, and I assume Haaland is the number one target for next summer. And I think it's blatantly obvious that that's a position that they will try and fix next season. But, you know, bringing in Harry Kane at 28 years old for 150 million, the Glazers aren't going to pay that. I'm not even sure if Solskjaer would happily accept paying that as well. So it just makes absolutely no sense to me at all. And it was a very kind of odd comment to make. And it kind of, it adds this whole Neville Kane dynamic of, you know, they did that interview on the golf course where he said he wants to leave. He's very fond and defensive of Harry Kane and not really acknowledging the fact that this was a guy who's kind of let Tottenham down really this summer. So yeah, I really struggled with the logic he was trying to make last night.
On Monday Night Football then, pretty entertaining game between West Ham and Leicester. Mikel Antonio providing the highlight of the night, I think, with his celebration with a card cut out of himself. But that's 33 goals and assists now for Antonio in his last 43 games. So he's kind of floating under the radar as this kind of absolute beast in front of goals, really. And West Ham, I mean, we mentioned them in our season preview as a kind of a side that's a little bit overlooked slightly. Obviously, they've lost Jesse Lingard from his loan spell. But other than that, they've been pretty much intact. And Saeed Benrahma is finally starting to find his feet and provide a bit of an impact. So obviously Leicester were down to 10 men pretty early in that one, but a very impressive win otherwise for West Ham.
Yeah, Davy Moyes, fun time boys. There's no stopping them. It's pretty incredible, really. Who would have thought West Ham would turn into this like actually really good, feel good, happy story? And like they're not doing it by, you know, absolutely scraping the ball on the barrel, kind of like Burnley style 4-4-2, get it up them. You know, they're like, that's the first two games of the season, and they've probably been involved in the two best games of the game week both times in terms of entertainment value. Anyway, I think you're absolutely right about the squad, Kev. I think they're probably a small bit overlooked in terms of what they bring. I think if they take the Europa League seriously, they could do real damage in that competition. I think they've got the kind of profile there that they might be able to do a bit of damage now. Whether they've got then the depth to again maintain a push in the league, who knows? But I think like while they're there, they may as well have a swing at it. Antonio's in this really nice spot, I think, where he is like a brilliant player for the system that Moyes is playing. But he is of an age and of a type that he probably is not going to get poached higher up the pyramid. So they kind of have him all to themselves, which is great. Like it's perfect for West Ham because he can keep scoring all these goals and keep assisting everything that he's assisting, being absolutely central to everything they do. And they're not really at risk of him getting robbed by a Spurs or a Liverpool or a Chelsea or United, because they kind of look at him and say, right, well, he's the age that he is and he plays the way that he plays, and we'll kind of look at somebody else. And so he can be as good as he wants almost, and they won't get poached within reason. So like if I was West Ham, I'd be really encouraged at how things have continued here. I know they kind of had a bit of a dip towards the back end of last season. When you say a dip, I mean, it's relative to compared to how they were in the first half of the season in terms of actually being in the Champions League places. But it's really, really encouraging to see that the kind of good times have stayed around and it's not back to any sort of pre-pandemic kind of malaise that the club felt it was in, that it actually has kept up this sense of momentum. And who knows where they can end up. I mean, it is a really competitive league this year, not just because there's, you know, four teams who can lay claim to the league. There's another four or five who can lay claim then to a couple of European places, and West Ham are absolutely in that conversation. And if they keep beating contenders like Leicester 4-2, then it's not going to be long before we say they're near the head of the conversation.
Yeah, I mean, Moyes tactically dominated Rodgers last night. Every single aspect of it was completely perfect for West Ham, just letting Leicester pass out from the back, pass it around, and then just hitting them so quickly, especially that first goal. But I thought Rice did a phenomenal job trying to cut out Tielemans, because when you do that against Leicester, that cuts out the supply chain to Vardy and Madison, and then they have big problems. Helped a bit by Ndidi having an absolute shocker. So it'll be interesting to see if Sumare can come in after a pretty big reputation in France and be a bit of an upgrade there for Leicester. And Soyuncu looks like a completely different defender without Evans as well. So there are a couple of things that went in West Ham's favour last night in terms of, you know, who they were playing against. But they've played really, really well in these first two games. And that kind of front three behind Antonio of Benrahma, Fornals and Bowen is really kicking into gear now, and it's almost perfect. And then if you have, you know, Rice and Soufal behind you, I mean, that's a very, very efficient front six who all seem to know what they're doing now. And then a very solid back four as well. So it is kind of the David Moyes blueprint that we saw at Everton a decade ago, kicking into effect again. He couldn't find it, obviously, at United, Sunderland, or Sociedad, or maybe even West Ham his first time around, which was a real relegation slog. But he'll feel a bit vindicated now over some of the comments he's said in the past 5 or 10 years, which some I agree with, some I don't. But you have to hand it to him. I mean, somebody made the point recently, I think yesterday on Twitter, that Moyes has been in the job the same length as Arteta at Arsenal, and the difference in kind of one being able to really stamp their mark on their side and the other still searching for their identity is very telling. And West Ham know exactly what they're about now. And that's, I think, very exciting for the fans going forward. When you think last season, you know, they started with Haller up front, who just didn't fit the West Ham style at all. And, you know, it was very difficult to understand how they were trying to play and what they were trying to do at the end of the Pellegrini era as well. They had a good squad on paper, but it just wasn't really filtering through to performances. So if they can keep everybody fit, the depth is obviously a bit of an issue, especially for Antonio. If he gets injured, you would be concerned, which he did last season, and they suffered heavily. But that aside, I think they're in great shape. And Moyes deserves a lot of credit for that.
The big game of the weekend then, Arsenal-Chelsea. If you still want to call an Arsenal fixture the big game of the weekend, I don't know. Is that starting to run out? But I mean, Chelsea absolutely played them off the park. Statistically, I think more than twice the amount of possession, double the amount of passes, considering it was an away game at the Emirates, is pretty impressive. And obviously, Arsenal were missing a fair chunk of players, senior players, obviously. Lacazette has yet to come back. Aubameyang only came off the bench. Thomas Partey hasn't been involved. I mean, the big stat to come out of this one was that Arteta has already lost more Premier League home games for Arsenal than Arsene Wenger did in his last 6 years at the club, which is incredible. So, I mean, like, it does feel like time is starting to tick on this Arteta experiment. You know, the Pep disciple at the time was the darling of kind of football coaching, and it felt like whoever was going to get him were in for a treat. But, I mean, you know, do Arsenal have to consider, you know, how long more can we put up with this before we might have to pull the plug on Arteta and this side that is simply showing no signs of progression really over the past couple of years, despite a couple of domestic trophies?
I think as much as I do think Arteta is under pressure and there's kind of word now that he has until the next international break to turn things around, the whole club needs to be looked at and shook. I mean, like, they've spent the most money this summer so far. They've spent, I think, is it 210 or 260 million over the last couple of seasons for a squad that there's nothing about it. There's nothing to it. Like, the recruitment, the strength and conditioning, the fitness, the injury issues that they seem to have, everything about the club is not up to scratch as far as I can see. I mean, the way that they hand their contracts willy-nilly to players over 30. Willian had his contract cancelled today. They weren't able to find anyone to pay them £1. They had to pay up his contract and get rid of him. Like, Aubameyang looks like a problem now. Gave him a big contract over 30. The Ozil contract, obviously, at the time, people thought they were backed into a corner. They did that. Everything about the club over the last couple of years has trended to a situation now where they have a squad hollowed out in the middle, loads of young lads, some older people, and nothing really in the middle of people in their peak. And then you throw on top, like you said, Kev, the kind of lack of progress under Arteta. I suppose nearly more worrying for me, they won their last 5 league games last year. They finished really strongly. And then they came back this season and it looks like they never had a sense of progress about them. So they seem to even lose progress that they make. If you took the badge off the shirt on Sunday, there's no reason to think that that was a side that would finish anywhere like higher than 13th or 14th in the league. They were absolutely terrible, like really honestly dreadful. And I think there's real problems there, but I think it goes deeper than Arteta. I think if you sacked him and you brought in Antonio Conte, to pick it, the most obvious name that's out there, not that they could get him, but in terms of picking the best available coach, probably is probably Conte. I'm sure Conte would do something with it, with that squad, but the team, the whole club rather, needs a look. Like Edu, as sporting director, looks like he is failing in his remit. The Cronkies, as we all know, aren't exactly the best owners to have. There doesn't seem to be anything smart about how that club is run at the minute. So I think whether Arteta runs out of time sooner rather than later, or he makes it a little further on, I think they really need to have a look at how the club is being run and take a proper look. They might need to take a little bit of medicine over the next while they fix the mess they got into.
Yeah, I'd agree. It's just all a bit shambolic, and we kind of predicted this in our season preview, but I didn't actually think it would be as bad as this after two games, and you know, you think of what they have to come. I don't see how Arteta can survive that, really. I mean, as Phil says, the problems run a lot deeper. I mean, even the way they managed the, you know, COVID initial PR, you know, sacking the mascot, for example, just utterly bizarre behavior. And the Willian contract, and you know, it seems so easy to pick up big contracts at Arsenal. And I know I can't speak too much because there's a similar philosophy at United, but, you know, they just seem to be going backwards at a very extreme pace. And they've spent a lot of money this summer, and you're kind of looking at it thinking no area of the pitch has really been improved significantly from them. I mean, the only slight thing that would have excited me as an Arsenal fan, if I was an Arsenal fan on Sunday, would have been the performance of Pepe, who really looked like, you know, a step up from what we've seen the past two seasons. There were three or four times where he took three Chelsea players out of the match, and he was just let down by teammates. So that would be one thing, perhaps, you know, him and Saka either side of an Aubameyang or Lacazette could be something to build on. And obviously they have Odegaard to come in now and Partey to come back, but I still think it's a decent squad that a very good manager would get a lot out of. And Arteta does seem to have this kind of pep issue of maybe overthinking things or maybe being overconfident against certain opposition. But he's lost 20 of his 60 Premier League games, which is just shambolic, really, for an Arsenal manager. You know, if he was kind of hanging on for draws, but they lose a lot of football matches. And then you put into context two really poor Europa League campaigns as well. They don't even have Europe now this season on the back of their poor performances last season. So it's, there really isn't much to hang his hat on at the moment for Arteta. And, you know, I'd kind of go against Phil a bit here and say if Conte did want to return back to London, you know, you might get two seasons of intense, successful football, and he might leave you with a few 34-year-old fullbacks. But I don't think that would be as big a problem for Arsenal as it is for maybe Inter Milan at the moment. You know, Arsenal still have a stable financial background that, you know, Inter have lost now with the Suning Group. So he is a manager who could come in and kind of put a formation to the type of personnel that they have. So he'd be the one who would stand out the most for me. But I think this Arteta experiment overall has failed quite miserably, really, considering the momentum they could have had after winning the FA Cup in particular and the signings that they have brought in. I mean, a lot of Premier League clubs would have liked to have brought in Thomas Partey, for example. Ben White was on a lot of clubs' radars. He was linked with United even back during his Leeds loan, for example. Tierney, all these guys were really hot properties at the time, and Arsenal did very well to get them, but it hasn't improved them at all. They've gone backwards. So in that instance, although Edu has his faults, I think you have to put that at the manager.
Elsewhere then this weekend in the Premier League, just to wrap up quickly, Leeds 2, Everton 2. Demarai Gray kind of appearing there as a pretty decent piece of business for Everton, at about €2 million, I think it was, from Bayer Leverkusen, which for an English player is absolute chips, especially considering its impact so far. City demolished Norwich 5-0. Jack Grealish off the mark there, his first goal for the club. If you want to call it that, I mean, the ball hit off him and went in, and then he proceeded to celebrate it as if he'd scored a 40-yarder.
Yeah, you were giving Fernandez stick for doing a slight celebration in pre-season, but Grealish took the piss there, really, didn't he? I mean, it hit off his left bollock, traveled over the line through somebody else's legs and he sticks his fingers in his ears. Jesus Christ. But no, I thought the City match was very interesting. I ended up watching the whole game, and Grealish played on the left wing, and it felt like every single play was, the instruction was to play to Grealish, you know, and it gave him a lot of freedom. And obviously Norwich, as we saw against Liverpool, aren't the best defensively, to put it simply, but it's probably the first time where I felt like Pep is really under pressure to make a big money signing a huge success. You know, he left Sterling on the bench, he left Mahrez on the bench, Foden I think was on the bench or not in the squad, so it really was a kind of you have to play well today, Jack Grealish kind of day for Man City, which I found really interesting, because obviously this is a club that signed a lot of football players for 40 or 50 odd million and haven't put that kind of pressure on them to play through them at every turn. But I really felt like that's what City were doing on Saturday, and obviously it paid off with the goal. But it'll be interesting to see how they manage that going forward. Obviously De Bruyne's out now for quite some time, if the ankle injury is as serious as some of the reports say. But I don't think you bring in a Jack Grealish to play left wing. So I'm interested to see how they manage that situation going forward.
Elsewhere then, Palace 0, Brentford 0. Patrick Vieira yet to win a game or score a goal there. So a pretty slow of the blocks. Something we did kind of pointed earlier on in the season. And Spurs, another 1-0 over Wolves. Dele Alli starting to find a little bit of form there, scoring from the penalty spot. Brighton 2-0 Watford, and once again Brighton beating their XG, something that they weren't doing last season. But another big win for Graham Potter's side, who do appear to beginning to click. You know, they've been kind of hinting at it for a while, and a nice team on paper, a good team to watch, but were struggling to win games and find the back of the net. But I think the big story coming out of there, and for Ireland coming into the international window, has been the absolute renaissance of Shane Duffy and popping up with a bullet header into the top corner.
Yeah, it's great to see, not least from an Irish point of view, in terms of it's great to see Duffy and a few other players rounding into some good form from the first time, what feels like forever. It feels like we're more used to seeing players go down injured or get COVID or be horribly out of form. It's great to see Duffy leading the charge of informed players. But it's also great because of how lost he looked last year. And not just off the basis of how it was going at Celtic, but it certainly helped. I was saying that his time in the team was probably nearly over with John Egan and Darragh O'Shea as probably better centre-back options. But now, like, it's amazing for Duffy that it's turned around. Like, he looked lost on the pitch for Celtic last year. By all accounts, he had a horrible time with the untimely and sudden death of his father as well. That seemed to really affect him. Just how happy he seems to be back playing and playing well for Brighton. How popular he seems with his teammates. You could see by the celebrations there after he scored, that kind of step above, yes, we scored a goal, it was, I'm really happy for you, Shane Duffy, to have scored that goal. And so it's great, because like Duffy's always come across, I think, quite well. He's always come across as somebody who's been very happy and proud to play for Ireland. He's always come across as somebody who's stepped up, and like when literally nobody else is doing anything, Shane Duffy was scoring goals from corners for us. So I think it's great that he is back in this vein of form. Long may it continue for him. I know there was suggestion that he might have, even after he started the first game last week, that he might still have been finding his way out of the club before the end of the transfer window. I'm not sure how another stellar performance and a goal changes that, if it does at all. But whether it be at Brighton, which I hope it is, or if it's somewhere else, hopefully Duffy is in a better frame of mind this year, first and foremost, and that he can continue good form, because it's great to see.
Yeah, when he joined Celtic, I actually had to check his age, because it just felt like he's been around for so long, but he was only 27 when he joined Celtic. And to just have such a horrible season, and I know a lot of Celtic players struggled last season, obviously, but you know, it's the type of move you would expect a Premier League defender to go in and flourish heavily. And to have such a brutal campaign and to really return to Brighton with probably his confidence at the lowest point possible, and to be, you know, man of the match in his first game, to score in his second game, you know, it's a fantastic, you know, kind of almost feel good story for us as Irish fans, and something we're always looking for, obviously. I don't think there's anything better than an Irish player performing well in the Premier League. And, you know, at least it gives Stephen Kenny an extra option, you know, to look at in central defence. I don't think he's been let down by the two players he's picked too often so far. But again, at least, you know, Duffy, and he's probably a better aerial threat in the opposition box as well. So, you know, we're always looking for Irish players in form, and it's great to see how he started the season.
Well, it will be interesting to see the makeup of the Irish squad this week for the upcoming internationals. And I mean, there have been a couple of goals, and obviously Duffy back in contention along with John Egan and Darragh O'Shea, and maybe even Andrew Omobemidele at Norwich, although he hasn't got on the team yet.
Yeah, a bit Adam surprising that, actually, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, Troy Powers has got off to a great start at MK Dons. I suppose going back to Brighton for a second, and one player that has kind of failed to kind of light the world yet is Aaron Connolly. And obviously he had a fantastic debut and burst out of the blocks. But I mean, he snatched at a chance, a great chance, really, against Watford. He should have scored, I think. But he's 21 now. He has the number 7 shirt. I mean, I was talking to someone on Twitter about it. I mean, it does feel like everything has gone before the actual football. And obviously, he's had a couple of injury issues. He's missed out on a couple of international squads. He had the whole COVID scenario that meant he missed the big Slovakia game last year. It does feel that, you know, like I don't expect him to be left out of the squad, but it does feel like that we should maybe start expecting a little bit of end product out of Connolly, considering he is has been rewarded with a new contract at Brighton and does have the number 7 chart, but hasn't really much to back that up yet.
I'm beginning to think and worry that end product might not be what we'll actually ever get from Aaron Connolly, and we might have to make do with another Irish Premier League player who has a really good Premier League career and offers loads to the national team without actually offering goals. I don't know. I think you're right. He came onto the scene with such a kind of a shock with those two goals. And I think what we thought we were getting another little Robbie Keane. He's not that he's exactly the same player, but I think we might be getting closer to a Shane Long in terms of somebody who will produce a lot for a Premier League team and offer a lot, but maybe won't ever be kind of that supreme goal scorer that we were maybe hoping for. Just by sheer dint of the fact that he has been rewarded for everything he's doing despite the lack of end product, I think maybe Brighton are seeing him as somebody who's not going to be the sharp end of their team. Maybe he's going to be the sharp end of our team due to lack of options. Maybe he will be played out wide as he has been a little bit when he has played under Kenny. But I think you're right, Kev. I think we probably expected a certain thing from Aaron Connolly with the way he came onto the scene. I'm increasingly of the opinion that we might never actually get that, and we might kind of have to make our peace with an industrious, skillful, hard-working wide forward as opposed to Robbie Keane Mark II.
Yeah, a lot of endeavour from Aaron Connolly, and there always is. But if you look at it, even his youth record, I mean, he only scored once for the under-19s, only scored once for the under-21s in 11 appearances. So he's never been the most prolific player in his career. And if you think he scored twice against Spurs, but he only had one more goal that season. So, you know, as a wide player, he does give you a lot of options in terms of, obviously, he still has pace. He works very hard. And at this stage of his career, he's probably still a better option than McLean in terms of lasting 90 minutes in an international football match. But that aside, I think we need a lot more than that creatively going forward for Ireland, because we don't really get that from midfield. So we need kind of that front three to really deliver goals and assists. And unfortunately, I don't think we're going to get that from Connolly.
And I mean, a couple of other players that are knocking on the door this week. Gavin Kilkenny has got off to a pretty decent start at Bournemouth. Reports today that Mido Odubeku won't be included in the under-21 squad, which is a little bit disappointing. I mean, it does feel like he's had his head turned either by England or Nigeria, either which remains to be seen. And he does seems to be holding a little bit of a grudge over being excluded from I think it was an under-17 squad at the time. But Conor Coventry, his club teammate, could be in line. And I mean, we already mentioned how well West Ham are going, but to see Coventry on the bench at West Ham in the Premier League has been a little bit of a boost as well. So, I mean, it will be interesting to see if there are any new faces, and especially when you look at the likes of Jason Malumbi, who hasn't been playing at Brighton. You know, he does seem to have the trust of Stephen Kenny, but hasn't really, you know, found his feet at club level just yet.
Yeah, and there are a few like that. I mean, Conor Noss isn't really making Gladbach squads either at the moment. So there are a few of those under 21 players in particular who need to look at where their future lies and what their role is at their clubs. But, you know, overall, I think, you know, we're in relatively good shape going forward. As we were chatting ourselves about yesterday, Michael Duffy, you know, being called up, I think is a very interesting option just because, you know, what we've seen him do from Dundalk, particularly in Europe, three or four seasons ago. He's not quite had that form since, but nobody in Dundalk has. But I still think he's a very exciting option for Ireland in terms of that, you know, midfielder who can be very creative and score goals for us. And it'll be interesting to see. He's linked with making the squad this week. So if he does, I think that would be, you know, a big upgrade on what we have at the moment. But overall, yeah, I think, you know, once he was dropped from the under 21 squad, sorry, the West Ham player you were mentioning a minute ago, once he withdrew from the under 21 squad rather last season, I think that was probably the end of his career for Ireland, which, as we spoke about heavily, at the time, you know, these guys have huge options, three or four international teams are chasing them. So it's not too surprising. And he scored a fantastic hat-trick against United in the under-23s as well. So, I mean, he's a huge talent. And it's unfortunate that he probably won't play for us. But again, it'll still be interesting to see how his career develops.
First, I thought you cheated bollocks of me, guys. Excuse me, this is live.
We're joined by journalist and Italian football expert Emmett Gates to cast a look at all things Serie A as they kick off the new season after what was a fairly unforgettable summer for Italian sports fans across a variety of fronts. Thanks for coming on, Emmett. Hope you're well.
Yeah, doing well. Glad to be back on to discuss the opening weekend of Serie A.
I suppose last time we had you on was prior to the Euro 2020 final. We had you on early on in the competition, actually. Italy ended up going all the way, fairly impressive, and obviously quite a bit of success in the Olympics, and they seem to be winning all around them.
Yes, I remember putting out a tweet when Italy won the 100-meter relay. I was just like, do Italy just win everything now? Because obviously they won the Eurovision earlier in the year.
That's right.
Then Italy winning the Euros, and then they did really well at the Olympics. They got 40 medals in total, 10 gold, which was, I think, Italy's best ever showing at an Olympics. So it was definitely a really good sporting summer for Italy as a country. But Serie A clubs probably didn't do too well in terms of retaining their players.
Mm. Well, on the Serie A front, you wrote for Forbes recently that despite losing some of its biggest talent, namely the likes of Lukaku, Donnarumma, Hakimi, potentially even Ronaldo as well before the month is out, it's kind of leveled the playing field across Serie A. I mean, are we looking ahead to what could be the most even balanced Serie A race in quite some time?
Yeah, ironically enough, I think as a consequence of losing a lot of marquee players, there is actually going to be a title race this season, probably as open a title race as there has been maybe since the days of the Seven Sisters at the end of the 90s. The quality overall of the league, as I wrote about in that piece, has been diminished by, you know, the big name departures. But you have, I would probably say, at least five teams of a similar quality. And I would say Juve, Milan, Inter, Atalanta, and probably Napoli in that five. Roma and Lazio probably just a bit behind, although in saying that you could have the Mourinho effect where Roma end up in the top three, but definitely those five, it wouldn't surprise me if any of them won the title, which is, you know, in general, obviously the quality has declined, but we will get a title race this year for a change, which is good for Italian football in general.
Well, I suppose looking at last year's title winners, Inter Milan, very imperious, kind of overcoming Juventus's dominance for the last decade or so, and it all seemed to look fairly rosy on the footballing front. But as we can now see, the financial kind of black hole that they found themselves in, the Suning Holdings group there at Inter, and obviously Antonio Conte bailed early enough in the summer. I think he probably saw the writing on the wall and was like, "I'm out of here, lads." So Simone Inzaghi taking on the job there. Obviously they've lost Lukaku, huge transfer to Chelsea. They've lost Hakimi. I mean, are they right back down with the pack now after last season, considering how dominated they were over the course of the Serie A campaign?
Yeah, definitely. I don't think that Inter will build on the success of last season. I think that was probably the pinnacle of the Sunning era, winning the Scudetto. The thing about it was, about the whole Inter's financial situation, is that if you paid close enough attention to the finances, that you knew that this was coming. As they were closing in on the title, these reports kept coming out about they need 300 million, 400 million, they need a bridge loan here, a bridge loan there. And you kind of felt, looking at 3 or 4 months down the road, you felt, right, they're going to win the title, but this is probably as good as it's going to get because of the way their finances were and the closing of stadiums in Italy because of the pandemic. Inter usually bring in around 60, 65 million euros in match day revenue, which is not really that high compared to, say, Barcelona, Manchester United, Paris Saint-Germain. But in Italy, they're by far and away the number one team for match day revenue. And basically, that's what they sold Hakimi for. And at the time, it was put, essentially it was put to, Sunning decided, right, we need to recoup 80 million euros and cut the wage bill by 15 to 20%. If you do that, then there's no more sales needed. So Hakimi was kind of seen as a sacrificial lamb. Okay, right, one big sale, we keep Lukaku, Lautaro Martinez, we keep the squad together. But the problem was Antonio Conte loves a 33, 34, 35-year-old wing-back and Arturo Vidal. So basically signed all these players on hefty wages that no one else then was willing to take on. So Inter was stuck with these players. And Conte was obviously the first to bail in, what, late May. He had a meeting with Inter's board and Sunning, Steven Zhang, and basically they told him the same thing. Look, we can't build on this success. You have to do X, Y, Z. And Conte was just like, okay, arrivederci. You've got your Scudetto. I'm gone. but he has to take some responsibility for that because he signed the likes of Alexander Kolarov, who was 34, 35, and Arturo Vidal. He signed them a year ago when the pandemic had just started. It wasn't like they were signed pre-pandemic and you couldn't foresee, obviously, a global pandemic happening. So Conte has to take some responsibility, but he just got up and left. So I think Inter now, you're looking at a position where Inter probably top four would be a good season, which is a big drop considering where they were only 3 months ago.
I suppose, obviously, the squad has had a little bit of an overhaul, but in terms of management, how much of a drop-off is Conte down to Simone Inzaghi?
I mean, Conte was arguably the best manager in the division last season, and Conte, for all his flaws and all his faults, Conte is one of the best managers in the world game. He can... Like, you only have to look what he did with the Italian national side at Euro 2016. If you look at that squad, it's one of the worst Italy teams in history, and he got them to within penalties of a semi-final. Conte and Conte alone more or less brought Inter to that title. So his departure is a big loss, but Simone Inzaghi in his own right, is a very good manager, did great things with Lazio when there wasn't really a lot of money. Claudio Lotito, Lazio's president, runs a very tight ship. Doesn't put any of his own money into the club. So basically, Simone Inzaghi works with the players that he has at his disposal. He's not Conte, but it's still... Inter could have picked a lot worse in terms of a manager. And he kind of is in the same mould. He utilised a 3-5-2 at Lazio or a 3-5-1-1, which is a variation of what Conte used at times at Inter. So, you know, you aren't going from, say, Antonio Conte to Maurizio Sarri. You know, it's kind of, you're still keeping within the same type of system. But it'll be interesting to see how Inzaghi gets on as the season progresses.
Emmett, definitely one team to watch this season, if the Sevilla friendly is anything to go by, will be Roma and Jose Mourinho, which was probably the craziest preseason game I can remember in a very, very long time. And a much different team now after replacing Zecco with Abraham. And if his debut is anything to go by, they'll be a very exciting team to watch. Not to mention, obviously, the form of Mkhitaryan and Vertu, who are kind of picking up where they left off last season. How do you think they'll go?
Well, with all Jose sides seemingly over the last decade, it can be brilliant or it'll be a disaster. I don't think there'll be much in between. But I think, you know something? I'm actually quietly confident that Mourinho will do decent things at Roma. I think the Friedkin group, which took over from James Pallotta about a year ago, they do seem willing to give Mourinho time. You know, he won't be judged on this season. They do seem... They've awarded him a 3-year contract, and I think he probably will, unless results are a complete disaster and they're in the bottom half of the table, I think he will get the 3 years. And he has that mentality that Roma lack. You know, Roma for a long time have had a very brittle mentality. The slightest bump in the road seems to derail the whole train. I think Mourinho will fix that. And he said himself he was short-sighted by Eden Dzeko leaving because he was counting on him for the season. But I definitely think Tammy Abraham is a very good signing, as we've seen from his debut against Fiorentina. And I don't think he even trained. He had a quarantine for 5 days. And he just obviously got to know his teammates maybe, I don't know, briefly a couple of days before the game. So Mourinho will bring a lot of fight and a lot of spirit, as we've seen from the Sevilla game. And also, Nicolò Zaniolo got sent off against Fiorentina. So there's men getting sent off everywhere under Mourinho so far. But I definitely think they can push for a top four. And obviously, maybe it's dependent on if they bring anyone else in before the end of the window. They were looking, obviously, they were in talks for Granit Xhaka from Arsenal, but seemingly Roma didn't offer too much or enough to Arsenal's liking. Rui Patricio is a good signing, I think, in Nets, because that was a problem area for Roma for a long time. Obviously, since they sold Alisson to Liverpool, in 2018, they've bought Robin Olsen and Paul Lopez, and they weren't really great successes. So that's a steady pair of hands at the back. And obviously, the Abraham, I think maybe they need another midfielder, someone in centre midfield. Jordan Veretout is a very good player, as is Brian Cristante. But I feel that they do need something in centre midfield. And if Nicolò Zaniolo can stay fit, him, Mkhitaryan, and Lorenzo Pellegrini all playing behind Abraham, I think I'm quietly confident that Roma can do well this season.
Emmett, just kind of looking through their squad here, and obviously, you mentioned a couple of players there, but one of our old friends from the summer, Leonardo Spinazzola, how do you think he's going to fit in? I presume he's still injured, but how do you think he'll fit in under a Jose team, considering how well he went? And he was kind of the darling of that Italian side, especially over the course of the group stage and some of the early knockout games.
Well, being Mourinho, it wouldn't surprise you if he basically knocked all the attackingness out of Spinazzola when he comes back. He'd be like, don't you pass the halfway line, because you know Mourinho likes defensively solid fullbacks. I mean, Spinazzola's out until January, and obviously with ruptured Achilles tendon, you don't know how players bounce back from that kind of an injury. Maybe if he loses some of his speed, because as we saw at the Euros, Spinazzola is lightning quick. But I think Mourinho has said that he's counting on Spinazzola as a new, almost like a new signing in January. But it will take him time to get back to the level that he was at the Euros. They've signed Vina, which I'll admit I don't know too much about. He's basically been brought in as a replacement for Spinazzola until January. And from watching the game against Fiorentina, he looks more defensively solid maybe than Spinazzola, but doesn't offer the same attacking threat. So it'll be interesting to see what happens when Spinazzola obviously starts running again and makes his way back to the first team. But I'd say a quick word on Tammy Abraham. I'm not sure if you lads watched the Roma-Fiorentina game, but there was a couple of times where he broke in behind, used his pace to break in behind the Fiorentina defence, and he played a pivotal role in Drakowski getting sent off because he beats him to the ball. Roma haven't had that kind of a striker. You're probably going back to Gabriel Batistuta or Vincenzo Montella 20, 15 years ago. Obviously, Dzeko, a great striker in his own right, but Dzeko was never the quickest, even in his mid-20s. Dzeko was always a target man who had very good control and who could drop deep and play others in behind defences, but not really running behind himself. So Tammy Abraham is going to offer something to Roma that they haven't had for a very long time.
And then in terms of Juventus, obviously, who are always the story of Serie A, not the best opening day for them, to say the least. And a few players, Szczesny in particular, coming in for a lot of criticism for Juventus fans for kind of taking his place for granted in the team. And, you know, reports coming out this week that Allegri doesn't really fancy McKennie, doesn't really fancy Ramsey, who's now injured for the next kind of 8 to 10 weeks, I think, or so. So they're all a bit up in the air, and that was even before the kind of Ronaldo drama started in the past few days. Do you think Allegri can fix them this season, or do you think that'll be a longer term kind of revival for Juventus?
It's difficult to say at this point. I think I believe that he will. I don't know if it will be instant, because Juve can't get rid of the players that Allegri wants to get rid of. Like, Juventus made a lot of mistakes. Fabio Paratici, the new Tottenham sporting director, he had two summer transfer windows and frankly made a balls up of both of them. Signing the likes of Aaron Ramsey, Adrian Rabiot on big contracts. Obviously, I know free is never free, but obviously there was no transfer fee involved, but he basically offered wages so large that, again, kind of like Conte at Inter, Juve can't get rid of them. And then you've got the Ronaldo saga that's hanging over the club. And Ronaldo's wages are crippling Juventus. Juventus were even struggling to pay Ronaldo's wages pre the pandemic. Now, 18 months later, they're massively struggling. And I don't know if you saw how the negotiations for Manuel Locatelli played out, but Juventus were like offering two packets of chewing gum and they were spreading it out over 15 years. And so Sassuolo were like, look, we want X amount of money in cash. They kind of relented after a period of weeks of back and forth negotiations, and Juventus finally got the deal over the line. But it's basically a free loan for 2 years, and then it's 35 million. It's 30 million euros and I think another 12 in bonuses, but like way down the road, because Juventus basically can't afford. They have no cash at the minute. So this all kind of ties into how Allegri, what he can do, the tools that he has to work with. I mean, don't get me wrong, Juventus still have a great squad and should comfortably finish in the top four. But I do think Allegri has his work cut out for him. And the 2-2 draw with Udinese, you know, I think there's still a bit of Arsenal in Szczesny. going by, you know, those mistakes, because he wasn't making them at Roma and he wasn't making those for the majority of his time at Juventus. But in saying that, over the last, maybe I'd say since the turn of the year, I have noticed more mistakes creeping into his game. I don't know if it's complacency or whatever. And in saying that, for the first Udinese goal, he wasn't completely, he wasn't at fault alone. Matthijs de Ligt was equally as culpable, because he let, I think it was Stefano Okaka, basically turn him. De Ligt got too tight and left the space in behind, which allowed the shot to go off. Chesney obviously saves it, but doesn't really deal with it that well. Concedes a penalty. De La Feo scores, lets Udinese back into the game. But the second one, you're just thinking, what are you doing? Like, kick the ball away. It's the 84th minute. What are you doing? But I mean, I think I am confident in the longer term that Allegri will be able to fix Juve, but Juve fans should not expect miracles right off the bat. But in saying that, it's good to see Paulo Dybala playing with a smile on his face again. And he was, in that first half, he was brilliant. Scored the first, set up Cuadrado for the second with a scorching 50, 60 yard diagonal pass. But yeah, I mean, Allegri definitely has his work cut out for him. And it was interesting that he did try to play, he did try to utilise Aaron Ramsey as a regista. I don't know if it worked or not. He had tried it in pre-season games. Didn't really pay off. But in saying that, you have to give a player time. You can't just expect great things after two or three games. But now he's out. Typical Ramsey, maybe, I suppose, of his time at Juventus. You know, he plays one game, two game. He's out for 2 months, comes back. But Locatelli will be a big signing. He will fit in. He will play that regista position. Arturo, when he comes back, Rodrigo Bentancur, that has the makings of a good midfield. But I think at the minute, Allegri is still kind of feeling around in the dark, trying to get his best team.
You mentioned De Ligt there, and how he was culpable for the first goal, for example, at the weekend. And from watching Juve in the last couple of years since he arrived, I sort of feel like he's flattered to deceive a little bit. And I would have concerns about how ready he is to take over that Chiellini mantle when he does eventually retire, even though it feels like he'll go on forever. How has his form and contribution been perceived in Italy since arriving?
He was a train wreck the first 6 months. I think in the first season he arrived, Serie A had very strict handball rules. Obviously, because the rules changed and Serie A referees were given 14 penalties a game for this, you know, ball hitting the hand, referee would blow. Because players didn't know where they could put their hands, behind their back, by their side. The Italian referees were just giving penalties out left, right and centre. So I think De Ligt must have gave away maybe 4 or 5 penalties alone in that open in maybe six months of his time at Juve. He did recover in the second half of his first season, and most of his second season, De Ligt was definitely one of Juve's better performers. But you kind of think he's not really developing as quickly as probably Juve would like him to. He's in his third season now, so you kind of think, if you can't learn from Giorgio Chiellini and Leonardo Bonucci after 2.5 years, 3 years, then are you ever really going to develop? So I would say, like, judging if he was a success or failure at this rate, you're probably on the fence, to be honest. If you consider what the outlay that Juve paid in bringing him to the club from Ajax, again, it's murky. But I mean, in saying that, De Ligt's still only, 21, 22? I mean, he's got a big future ahead of him. But you do worry that he's still not learning. There are some basics to defending that he's still not picking up. And if you're sitting under that learning tree from Chiellini and Bonucci, who together, you know, they were a combined age of 450 and they won the Euros. If you can't soak up that knowledge from those two, then I don't know, I'm lost for words.
Emmett, arguably the most stable of those kind of top four, five, six clubs coming into the season is weirdly Atalanta, a club who were kind of built on the idea of kind of turning over players and a relatively quick turnover. Maybe they're kind of able to thrive a little better than some of these other clubs, not as used to things like that. They've established themselves now firmly as kind of a top four club in Italy, which in itself is a fantastic achievement, given the size of the club and the model that they operate on, as we mentioned. Do you think this year could finally be the year that they really push for that title? I know, like, the last couple of seasons we've had lads on talking about Serie A at the start of the year, and they've said maybe this year for Gasperini. With the upheaval at the other kind of more glamorous clubs, could this year actually be the year for Gasperini and co?
I think so. I can't say for, you know, I can't give a definitive answer. I will say that selling Christian Romero to Tottenham is a massive blow, because for me, Romero was arguably the best defender in Serie A last season. And they've brought in Mera Demiral from Juventus, who is a good signing, but he's not as good as Romero is. Although in saying that, I didn't think Romero would be as good as he was. But obviously Gasperini has coached him, so maybe Gasperini can do the same for Demiral. I was worried, obviously, once Inter sold Lukaku, they were linked with Dusan Sabata to replace him. And I was worried that if they sold him, that might be one departure too many. Because obviously they sold Papu Gomez, who was pivotal to how Atalanta played in January. And his fallout was Gasperini. So I kind of felt if Sabata went, it could be the end of Atalanta, even in the top four. But it seems that he's going to stay. And they won against Torino on the opening day. And it was a hard-fought victory. The type that, you know, they always say the champions dig out a result even when they're not really playing that well. So I think the stability of, you know, there's only Atalanta and Milan out of the top seven teams in Serie A last season have kept the same coach. So having that stability definitely is an advantage. And part of me would love Atalanta to win it this season, because it would be one of the greatest, I think, sporting miracles in football for, I don't know, obviously since Leicester winning the Premier League. But I definitely wouldn't rule them out. Honestly, I would say it depends on how far they go in the Champions League. If they get knocked out in the group stage and they're done by December, all eggs will go in the Serie A basket. And at that point, I would maybe put them favourites to win it. But as I was talking about earlier, it kind of depends also how Max Allegri figures out the pieces of the Juve jigsaw. If he can get it figured pretty quick, then Juve would probably be favourites. But if he doesn't, I would fancy Atalanta to give a serious go.
You mentioned that at the top of the piece, Emmett, that kind of rounding out the kind of maybe five key contenders is Napoli, who the squad probably hasn't undergone massive surgery this summer. There's not been loads in and outs. They have been on the managerial merry-go-round, though, again. The ever kind of steady hand of Rino Gattuso replaced by Luciano Spalletti after a couple of years away. What difference do you think Spalletti could make to this side after kind of a few up and down years under Gattuso?
You know, that's actually that's a difficult question to answer, because Spalletti, I feel, has gone backwards as a coach over the last maybe half a decade or decade. His absolute peak was his first spell at Roma, that brilliant Roma team of the late noughties when he had Totti as a false nine. And then he went to Zenit, and I don't know what happened in Zenit. He went a bit crazy or something, I don't know. But ever since he's come back from Zenit, he's never been the same coach for me. So I think now that he's in at Napoli, and obviously Napoli's owner, Aurelio De Laurentiis, is a prickly character to be favourable to him. So it could either, kind of like Mourinho at Roma, I think it could be brilliant or it could be an absolute disaster and Spalletti could be gone by Christmas. But he will get Napoli playing maybe more attractive football than they did under Gattuso. Gattuso made them very solid, but at times there was a lack of flair, I would say. And Spalletti will probably go for a 4-2-3-1 formation to try to get the most out of Insigne. Victor Osimhen, who I expect big things from this season, although in saying that, he got sent off at the weekend and now he's suspended for 2 games. As you said, Napoli haven't lost any big players, which is good considering, you know, the rate that every Italian team is losing, seemingly losing marquee players. They still have Kalidou Koulibaly. Insigne is still here just about, but there are rumours that Inter might try and sign him either this summer or next. His contract's expiring in a year, and him and De Laurentiis are back and forth on a new deal, and apparently there is a big gap in what Insigne wants and what De Laurentiis is willing to offer. So this could be Insigne's last season, and it is probably the last season of this Napoli team, who've been together for many years, to actually win something concrete. Yes, they won the Coppa Italia in 2020, but to win the league, they've all been together maybe 6-7 years at this point. A lot of them come close under Maurizio Sarri in 2018, when Napoli actually were top of the league with three games to go, and then they capitulated to Fiorentina. So Spalletti has a great squad there. I don't know. Spalletti, for me, is maybe slightly past his peak as a manager. But again, maybe like Mourinho, he's maybe found his ideal environment in Naples. Napoli are a real unknown quantity, I think, at this point. But in saying that, they did win against Venezia, which is, the type of game that they maybe would have lost under Gattuso last season.
A side that you intimated might struggle to maybe make the top four, given how competitive it is this year, but one that I think is maybe an interesting study going into this year is Lazio. Coming off the back of a couple of seasons under Simone Inzaghi, who made them quite a kind of functional, steady side, got them into the Champions League, also finished kind of as low as eighth in the middle there. They're now under the coaching of Maurizio Sarri, who is obviously very well known and revered for his kind of expressive and his exciting style of possession football. It's quite a change for that Lazio squad to deal with, going from a manager who was more akin to Antonio Conte, the man he replaced at Inter, than he is to Sarri. What do you think about Lazio's prospects for this year? And do you think they have the squad to play the way that Sarri would like them to play?
I don't think so right from the get-go. It will take time. Like, even Sarri made his name, within Italy, he made his name at Empoli, and then he went to Napoli, and then that's when the awareness of Sarri and Sarri ball, it kind of become global, because you would see 30-second highlights on Twitter of Napoli getting the ball in their corner flag and ping-ponging it around and scoring. But that took, to get to that point, you know, it all looks brilliant on a 30-second, you know, YouTube video or Twitter video. But to get to that point, it took Napoli maybe about a season and a half or 2 seasons to get to that point where everything became automatic, and Mertens would know where Insigne was, who would know where Caleon was, and then you'd Hamsik involved. So I think with Sarri now at Lazio, he's going to need time to get the players, A, that he wants, and B, accustomed to how he wants to play, which is vastly different to how Simone Inzaghi had utilised him. So Inzaghi is a very pragmatic coach. You know, whatever, he works to the strengths of his players, where Sarri is a very system manager. It's like, you know, my system is the way we're going, and you need to tailor your qualities to fit in my system. So I don't think you're going to see Sarri or Sarri ball or Sarissimo. You're probably unlikely to see it this season, I would say. Letito arguably will give him time. I mean, Simone Inzaghi was manager of Lazio for, 4 or 5 years? So, I mean, I think Sarri will get time. Granted, results are good. And Sarri is one who really, I don't know if you saw it last week, he was talking about the transfer market. He was like, it bores me. You know, stop asking me questions about transfers. I don't care. He likes to work with what he has and doesn't really make any requests, which will suit Letito down to the ground, because Letito is very frugal, shall we say, when it comes to stomping up for transfer fees.
Emil, we have a question in from Twitter. Niall Bleaks asks, where will Milan finish this year? Another side has been a bit of a known quantity and might benefit from the evening up and the balancing of Serie A this season.
I think Milan will do well, to be honest. I think definitely they will build on last season, and I expect them to finish in the top four. Again, they could win it depending on... I don't think their squad has enough depth for to maybe, you know, say round of 16 quarterfinal Champions League plus try and aim for the Scudetto. But if they were to get knocked out early on in the Champions League, I could see, I similar to Atalanta, I could see them putting all their eggs in the Scudetto basket and definitely going for it. I mean, they've bought well. They bought in Mignon from Lille, who looked, the game against Samp last night was my first time getting to watch him, and he looks a very good goalkeeper, a good replacement for Donnarumma. Obviously, they kept Fikayo Tomori, got him on a permanent deal. He's formed a good partnership with Simon Kjær. They bought Olivier Giroud in, the man with the most immaculate hair you'll ever see from a football player. He's coming as a vice Zlatan, to carry the burden, because Zlatan started last season very well, but post-Christmas, he spent more time on the treatment table than he did on the pitch. And he really carried Milan in the first half of last season. So they got Giroud, and I think Giroud would be in a good shout of winning Capo Cannonieri at the end of the season, you know, top goal scorer. And I think they're about to bring in Bakayoko again for a second loan spell from Chelsea. He'll add a bit of depth to midfield. If they can keep Frank Kessie fit, plus Theo Hernandez, and maybe bring in, they're looking at another number 10, because obviously Hakan Çalhanoğlu went across town to Inter on a free. And at the minute, they only have Brahim Diaz, who impressed me a lot against Samp last night. So if Milan maybe can bring in one or two more extra players, and Stefano Pioli's got them well coached, definitely would not rule out Milan winning the title. I've said this about every single team that we've reviewed, but it's kind of like, as I said about in the piece, it's so open, you can't really call it. You know, for the lack of quality, every team's kind of at the same level.
Mm. And we haven't even got Sassuolo, another team that's been knocking on the door over the past year or two, so it feels a little bit too early in the season to ask you for to call a winner at this point.
Yeah, I would say maybe towards Christmas time. Maybe I think it's way too early at this point, which is a good thing, because I mean, for the last since 2012, it's been who's going to win it? Juventus. Mm. You don't even have to think. So I'm glad that I'm being a bit vague here, you know, because all the teams are at a similar level. But I was mightily impressed with Milan last night against Sampdoria. That was the kind of game last season that they would have drew or maybe lost, but they got a win and they were defensively solid. And Samp tested them at times. So, yeah, I honestly could not call it at this point. In late August, I cannot call it.
And I suppose good news for British and Irish-based Serie A fans, it is back on our screens on BT Sport with James Richardson, so a nice bit of nostalgic action there every weekend with him. Emmett Gates, thanks a million for coming on.
No problem, lads. I was glad to be on, and hopefully I'll be back on again in the future.
Respect, man. So we leave it there. So, okie doke. Good night and God bless.